Welcome to Beauty 4.0, Decoding the Business of Beauty, a podcast by Cosmetic Design. We take you inside for a close-up of the innovations and innovators behind the beauty and personal care industry and find out just how they are shaping its future. On this episode, I'm joined by Kesh Gunasinghe, who leads Kenvue's beauty R&D in Asia-Pacific. Kesh has been behind some of the most iconic beauty brands today, including Neutrogena, Clean & Clear, Aveeno and Dr. Ci:Labo. Kesh and Kenvue are at the forefront of research in the skincare industry, and he is here today to share some insight into the fascinating world of skincare science. So if you're interested in some skin-centric chat, stay tuned. Hey Kesh, how's it going? Great to have you on the pod.
Hey Amanda, great to be here. Looking forward to our chat.
So we're here today to talk about skin and skincare, which is the most important category in the Asia-Pacific region. And I think my listeners would really like to hear your perspectives on how this category is evolving.
The category is changing a lot in the last few years, I think, especially post-COVID. We have seen the category really evolve significantly. I see three big trends in those evolutions. The first one is that, you know, coming out of COVID, you're seeing the rise in personal health, personal care, and self-care. So skincare is becoming a little bit more medicinalized. And, you know, consumers are much more comfortable with going to a clinic for a clinic treatment or things like laser or UL therapy. And, you know, globally, we are seeing that this dermocosmetic category is growing twice as fast as, you know, the global skincare category as a whole. Typically fueled by, you know, two places. So the face care category in China and in the US as well. So, you know, I can see this really coming to life in these medical aesthetic treatments. And this has been a huge shift, right? So we're now seeing skincare products being kind of used in these medical aesthetic areas. So you have adjunctive care, so pre-treatment, during treatment, post-treatment, skincare is becoming much bigger. And then we're using those treatments and those skincare to prolong your time between treatments as well, which I think is a really big growing trend. And it's seeing kind of the evolution of skincare as well.
And this Medi beauty space is primarily affecting mostly the derma beauty space?
Yes. Yeah, it's typically affecting the derma beauty space. But, you know, I was just in China at the beginning of February, but you are seeing, you know, this adjunctive care start to now trickle into the more, you know, the more mass categories. It definitely started there. But, you know, you are seeing consumers looking for data around, well, how will this, my serum, you know, work if I go for a skin peel, you know, or will it provide similar results, or can it help in that space? So definitely, I think we are starting to see it trickle down, but it's right now mainly concentrated in that derma space.
I've also noticed as well that the derma coats are also going into the regular skincare category as well.
Definitely.
And like even the luxury players as well are using those derma coats. Yeah.
Those super concentrated kind of ingredients, the look and feel. Yeah, you're very right. It is definitely much more moving in that medical aesthetic kind of space.
Right. Are there any, you know, under-tapped areas you think companies have yet to fully explore?
So there's a couple of other ones, right? So I think we're still seeing the big issues, you know, pigmentation, skin sensitivity, skin aging. You know, skin aging is an interesting one, and I think this area is under-tapped in some markets, but then now starting to get much bigger and growing. So we are starting to see skin aging evolve, right? It's moving from a problem solution. I have wrinkles, so I go buy an anti-wrinkle product or an anti-aging product to treat my wrinkles, to now, especially in this the younger demographics, you know, the 15 to 30-year-olds and even a little bit older, starting to look for proactive, preventative skincare. So moving from I'm seeing wrinkles, I'm going to start using anti-aging products, to I don't want to get these wrinkles in the first place. What am I going to do with my skin care to ensure I don't get wrinkles, right? So big in China, I think moving across the region now, you know, moving into Southeast Asia and actually even into other parts of the world like North America, and we call it, you know, pre-aging. And, you know, the growth in pre-aging is huge. It's growing much faster, 8 times faster than the total facial care category and 3 times faster than anti-aging. Because it is, I think, you know, consumers really, they don't want to deal with the problem, right? Why deal with a problem when I can not get the problem in the first place? And that does, as an industry, you know, it does put, you know, pressure on us to find those kind of solutions that are more preventative, because prevention is harder. Because you know, you have to make sure people constantly use products and keep up with it, because you know, it is a very different way of you know, solving problems.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen the recent trend on social media right now that in North America they have these things called Sephora kits, where you have even 13-year-olds going into Sephora making a mess out of it. They're looking for things that they don't even need to look for, like acids and stuff, even though I don't think they have pores yet.
exactly. Well, everyone's born with pores.
Yeah, okay, so you know, visible pores or lines.
Yeah, but you're right. It's definitely a trend. I have seen those. And you're seeing a lot of brands call it out now as well, right?
Exactly, that yeah.
If you're young, use these kind of products. And that's definitely something that, you know, we also feel really strongly about. I mean, a part of my responsibility is also looking after our baby category, which means we have a very good understanding of baby care and, you know, what other, and, you know, we're very much a skin first company. So we understand baby skin really well. We probably have more research on baby skin than just about anyone else. And, you know, baby skin is different and children's skin is different. So it does need solutions that, you know, someone in their 40s may have, that kids do not need those. So, you know, we do have to be choiceful about
that.
Yeah,
but it's definitely showing that, you know, that pre-aging category might even grow even bigger as you know,
younger and younger.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, you know, research, you know, can you share any insights with us into the latest breakthroughs in skincare R&D that have potential to be game changers for overall skin health?
For me, it's kind of what we started on this medical aesthetics. Something that I'm super passionate about, you know, being in the consumer health part, I think medical aesthetics and the combination of skincare and dermatology into, you know, one area, I think is extremely interesting. And I think it's definitely going to be something that's going to grow. You know, things like hyperpigmentation continue to be challenges. Again, looking at, you know, collagen health, areas like that. Solutions-wise, why I really like this medical aesthetic category is, from an R&D perspective, it means that you can provide very different kind of solutions to consumers that are different from a very traditional cream or a serum or things like that, right? So, for example, we just launched last year a product in our Dr. Ci:Labo brand around microneedles. So I'm sure you know what microneedles are. It's the typically, you know, applied in clinic, and it's usually a patch with, you know, thousands of little needles in it. So we took inspiration from that, and we actually created a serum with microneedles inside it. So each microneedle is made of hyaluronic acid, and the serum itself is a retinol serum. So you're now doing what you do in a clinic, which is getting microneedling to improve you know, your anti-aging results. Now we're delivering that in a serum. So the microneedles go in, they help to actually help the retinol absorption. So we have about 1.5 times the absorption compared to a normal serum with these microneedles. And because the microneedles are made of hyaluronic acid, they then melt into your skin and help improve your skin barrier. So we would not have thought about that kind of product a few years ago, because we weren't thinking about it from this medical aesthetic kind of space. So now that we're looking there, drawing inspiration from there, working with, you know, with a different kind of dermatologist, it does lead to very different solutions, which I think is going to lead to more and more breakthroughs across the industry.
Any research into ingredients? Because I'm hearing a lot of things on things like exosomes, you know, any of these kind of things that you think are interesting?
Yeah, I mean, there's always ingredient research that is happening. Exosome is a big area where, as we move into this space, though, and as we work with dermatologists more and more and more, and especially around brands like Dr. Ci:Labo, what we find, though, is that dermatologists, HCPs, they like tried and trusted ingredients. And that's really core for us. So it's about combining the, you know, looking at the problem we're trying to solve. What is the gold standard? Maybe combining those with some new ingredients, but really using those key technologies like retinol, like, ingredients like we have like 377, to really help kind of ground it in that HCP space and then combine those with some of the new ingredients, because HCPs, they're doctors, right? They want solutions that they know and they can trust. So as we develop the data, I think that's really how we are grounding a lot of our solutions as well at the same time.
Interesting. And another trend we're seeing as well is there's a lot of talk about the wellness aspect of skincare, yes. You know? So yes. I'd like to find a bit more, what's your view on this, like, you know, whole skin, mind, mood space?
Sure. I'm a big proponent of it. We call it the skin-brain axis, very similar to the skin or the brain-gut axis, which you may have heard about. And, you know, we are seeing a lot of data and a lot of research in this space. Another new term I've heard lately is this thing called neuroglow,
yeah, uh-huh.
Which is really coming through as well. And we have seen the connection between physical and mental health. I'm sure we've all been in a position where we've been super stressed and we've broken out with pimples, or if you have atopic dermatitis, maybe had a flare up. And so I'm sure we've all experienced those, but we've been looking at it in the context of anti-aging and pre-aging, like we just talked about. So we just completed a few studies. Interestingly, we did the study with dermatologists and psychologists. So we really want to get really deep into the mental well-being aspect of it. And what we found was that, first of all, mental health differed by age group, especially in places like China. So, we found that at different age groups, typically, we found that, you know, their stress and mental health levels were different, and that there was in these studies significant link to their skin health and skin performance. We found that people with higher levels of stress were typically experienced more skin sensitivity, skin tone problems, also loss of elasticity. These were more strongly correlated at a younger age group, interestingly. This idea that younger people are more stressed these days, maybe that there's a bit of a link there. We also found that, you know, a greater portion of women in these studies, when they experience, you know, high stress levels, they reported high, you know, signs of aging, like I mentioned, rough skin, dull skin. And this kind of created this vicious cycle, and then they got stressed about having rough, dull skin. So you're now getting this vicious cycle that, you know, they really want to get out of, but are finding it really difficult, right? So it made them uncomfortable and gave them negative feelings. So really interesting work. It's something that I'm very passionate about, this idea of mental health, because our skin is our largest organ. It does. And typically, things manifest on your skin first. And what we're seeing is that mental well-being and stress is one of those places where it does happen.
Right. Does this challenge, you know, formulators and scientists, especially when it comes to, you know, approving that such products work?
It does. It does. Again, it comes back to that preventative space, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we look at it in a couple of ways. One is, do we have the right ingredients to treat the condition? So it's if it's manifesting as dull, dry, sagging skin, then let's treat those. I think there are solutions that we can do to do that. But when it comes to the actual mental health space, what we are doing is looking at how we change how we do our studies. You know, there's one thing that we can do around how we formulate our products, but then we're also looking at how we can change how we test our products. You know, we do a lot of clinical testing. Now, when we're doing our clinical testing, we're also, like I mentioned, partnering with oftentimes with psychologists in helping us do our clinical studies so that we can have really solid data around the skin benefits that you have, but then also any kind of emotional response or, you know, mental health improvements that we have. And the benefit of working with psychologists is they have standard tools that they can use, you know, specific questionnaires that have been standardized to really help to determine things like quality of life. So we've done quality of life studies for in places like acne care, in places like atopic dermatitis, eczema studies previously. We're now using similar methodologies on face care and on anti-aging studies. So it is changing how we test, and it poses a challenge to both our formulation teams as well as our clinicians and our clinical researchers in developing these new methods of testing. We also look at ingredients, right? So we're also finding that we need to deliver the benefit in the right way. So common ingredients that we might use, you know, retinol and vitamin C, you know, that really are targeting some of those clinical endpoints that I had mentioned earlier around rough, dry, hyperpigmented skin. We want to maybe deliver solutions that have retinol and vitamin C together. We know that's incredibly difficult to do. They tend to destabilize each other. So we are looking at different solutions around maybe not the ingredient, but the delivery system becomes really critical. So looking at, you know, we just launched another product last year that is biphasic. So we have retinol in one layer and vitamin C in another layer. And you shake it, combines it together, you apply it, then it separates back out again, so it stays stable over a period of time as well. So it does enable us to look at different solutions.
Interesting stuff. Provide. Right. Well, this brings me to my next question about, you know, efficacy and performance versus, you know, marketing and trends. How do companies balance these forces?
It is a good one. For me, it comes down to, you know, at least for Kenvue, it comes down to living into our values. So one of our values is we put people first, right? Which means ultimately we need to have a really strong understanding of, like you said, those drivers of efficacy and those drivers of performance. And then the trends come second, right? If we know what those are, what consumers really want to see in their products and what benefits they're looking for, and then we back that up with really strong science and really long data so that they know we are delivering against that, then we can combine those with maybe that new trendy format that's super interesting for them. But ultimately, you know, our job is to, you know, provide them with solutions that work for them, because that's what makes them come back. And that's really the key for us is, you know, we want them to come back. And, you know, understanding what trends are going to be the ones that are long lasting is really, really important. But we typically want to always start with efficacy and performance as our ultimate, you know, test.
What about the challenges on inflation? You know, what does this mean for the future of innovation and beauty?
Great question. You know, inflation is becoming much more of a challenge, and it is changing consumer habits in terms of how they purchase. And what we've seen is now consumers are much more likely to buy like a beauty staple, but then combine that with a premium, more luxury product, because skincare is, you know, it is a way of getting some luxury into your you know, life as well. Especially as everything goes up, you know, skincare is relatively good value. So you can spend a little bit and get a lot. What we are seeing though from an innovation perspective is that the overall regimen of products that a consumer might be using is coming down. And that means that, you know, multitaskers are going up. So products that deliver multi-benefits are going up. So, you know, like mentioned that example about retinol and vitamin C earlier, the ingredients that typically may not go together, those become more important, right? Because you still want the same benefits. You just want them in a smaller regimen. And that is a challenge for us. And, you know, we continue to look for solutions. But again, it comes down to knowing what a consumer wants, giving them value through that, but then also providing that them with that little bit of luxury and indulgence at the same time. And that has led to kind of more of that premiumization of even that mass category, like we talked about earlier around dermacosmetics. We're starting to see that kind of trickle down in, and that's typically very high end, right? But it is moving down. But yeah, that's really the challenge for us, is delivering those three things: value, efficacy, and that premium kind of indulgent feel.
Yeah, what I feel is that, you know, that the idea of luxury, it may not be tied to a price tag anymore.
Exactly.
You know, you can find like great products. Like I'm a really big fan of Neutrogena Hydro Boost, actually. And I think that that is a really great formula. And to me, that is also luxury because it's such a great product.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. I worked on that product a very long time ago. But again, it was about understanding what the consumer, those consumer touch points are, you know, what really makes them feel good, and those luxurious aspects of those products. And if you can give them that at any price point, I think they'll, consumers are going to
be recognize happy. Quality at any price point, definitely.
Exactly.
Right. You mentioned that you work a lot on baby care, so maybe let's touch into that, you know. Maybe you could tell me a bit more about, like, you know, what are the key differences in formulating skincare products for children compared to, you know, us adults?
Sure. So again, it starts with understanding baby skin.
Mm-hmm.
So typically, you know, we've done a lot of research in looking at the structure of baby skin. And it is different to the structure of, you know, adult skin. It is most notably thinner. And that leads to many follow-on attributes, right? So because it is thinner, it's less resistant and less resilient than adult skin. Interestingly, it recovers really well. So that's one of the great attributes of baby skin, but it can be more sensitive, you know, to many insults that could be physical, chemical, microbial insults. So they can all have an impact on baby skin, which means and it also means products can penetrate deeper, easier than in an adult. Another consequence of the thinness is that baby skin tends to dry out. So, you know, even if it looks super plump and moisturized, it tends to be drier than adult skin. And so when we are formulating for baby care, we do need to have all of these considered. It needs to be more gentle. So we are limited. We limit the ingredient choices that we make when it comes to baby skin, because it may not be able to handle some of the, you know, stronger active ingredients that we would typically use. And as we're doing that, it also means that we need to ensure we're constantly focusing on the baby skin barrier, continuing to ensure that the baby skin barrier stays strong. Because we also know, because of these, you know, the other big challenge when it comes to baby skin is it's much more susceptible to things like UV. It's also more susceptible to things like eczema, so atopic dermatitis. You know, we worked on some studies with some partners, and that they actually showed that atopic dermatitis is often, you know, you often get it as a very young baby, but that can, if it's not treated right, it can lead to something called the atopic march. So the atopic march is starting at atopic dermatitis and then maybe getting onto different allergic reactions as you age. So preventing that early and stopping that atopic march and preventing atopic dermatitis at a very young age is very important. So they are some of the conditions that we look at. We also look at things like the biomarkers in baby skin tend to be different to the biomarkers in adult skin. So for us, it's ensuring as we're developing our baby products is that we are always focusing on early preventative measures. It's like we're getting into that pre-aging space very early when it comes to babies, but it is about ensuring that baby skin stays very well protected at a very young age.
Mm. what are the kind of like white spaces you think there are still there in the category?
So white spaces, I think actually it kind of links to something that, so sun care, I think, is a white space. Many parents don't want to put sunscreen on their babies, but it's actually really important that you go out into the sun. You know, you get vitamin D. It's, you know, kids have fun in the sun, but I know many parents that we talk to would rather not use a sunscreen. So I think sunscreen as a space is actually an important one for babies. We do want them to go out in the sun, but we want them to be protected. So using the right SPF level, and, you know, ensuring that they are protected as they go out in the sun, I think is a really important one. The other white space, or I guess it's a bit of a myth, is around, I think the idea of microbiome is a really important one. So many people think that all bacteria is bad, but we know that, you know, your microbiome is actually really important, and it's a really important part of maintaining good skin health. So I think that space around microbiome and continuing to ensure that we have the right, you know, microbiome for your skin is a really important white space. We have, you know, our Aveeno brand, for example, focuses really a lot on microbiome and ensuring that we are, you know, making the good bacteria stay and, you know, using that to actually prevent bad bacteria. So it's not about just antibacterial soap and washing away all bacteria, but building the right kind of products that will help your microbiome flourish, which is also very good for your skin.
Yeah, education, really important point. So do social media platforms like TikTok, Instagram, do they help or hinder consumer education efforts? You know, what are the challenges associated with that?
I think it's a bit of a double-edged sword, honestly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They help a lot, you know, they help in reach, they help with education, like you said, debunking myths, they help so much, you know.
Or spreading myths.
Yeah, so, and that's the other side of the sword, right, is that oftentimes, especially as a scientist, sometimes I go on TikTok or Instagram and I see stuff and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe they said that. Because, you know, the data is not there, or they cherry pick information. They may be providing misleading information. So it is hard. It is hard. So one of the things that, you know, we like to do is, and it's really hard to communicate science in an effective way so consumers can understand it. What we found works best for us is, you know, you and your listeners can search for Neutrogena Skin U, as an example, on TikTok. So Skin U is actually our scientists, and they talk directly to consumers. So they use consumer language to talk about ingredients, our products, but also skin in general. So it's getting the experts, people that are really passionate about skincare, to talk about it. We also do things like work with a lot of influencers to help us in that space as well, because they're very good at communicating some science, so we can learn a lot from them in how to communicate it. So it's always good to talk to them. But, you know, things like Skin U are something that we're really proud of, because it is getting the experts out in front and talking about our science in a way that consumers can understand. And that's a big passion point for me as well.
I think we should get you out there more, Kesh, because you're very passionate and you're very good at communicating all of this.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, this is all really good stuff, Kesh. Really, thank you again so much for coming on the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed yourself, and I hope you come back again.
Definitely, my pleasure.
This has been Beauty 4.0, Decoding the Business of Beauty, a podcast by Cosmetic Design, bringing you the inside stories on the innovations and innovators behind the beauty industry.